in my life. Years ago, right after she quit seeing Justin Timberlake, I got set up on a date with Cameron Diaz. At the time, I was working out a lot and had developed big arms. For the date, I prepared accordingly, taking a long walk with my sleeves rolled up to my shoulders so the guns were appropriately tanned. Pro tip, this helps them look bigger. Yes, I literally tanned my arms for this date. The date was a dinner party with a bunch of other people, but upon seeing me, Cameron got almost instantly stoned. It was clear that she was not interested in me at all. But the party went on, nevertheless, and at one point we were playing a game, Pictionary, I think. As she was drawing, I said something witty to Cameron, to which she said, "Oh, come on," and proceeded to punch me in the shoulder. Or at least, that's what she meant to do. But she missed, and instead, punched me smack in the side of the face. "Are you fucking kidding me?" I said, realizing I'd just been punched in the face by Cameron Diaz, and my big arms hadn't helped at all. This was about 15 years ago, but she'll probably call me, don't you think? Then, there was this other time. In 2004, I flew out to Chris Evert's Tennis Academy in Florida for a charity event. The Chris Evert Bank of America Pro Celebrity Tennis Classic. It was a veritable who's who in Hollywood, but I was most interested in Chevy Chase. Chevy had long been a hero of mine. In fact, his performance in the movie Fletch had changed my life forever. One chilly night in L.A., my best buddy Matt Andre and I went to see a preview screening of Fletch, and at one point, we were literally rolling in the aisles with laughter. Chevy must have had 300 jokes in that movie, and he landed each one perfectly. Later, as Matt and I sat at the bus stop awaiting our ride home, I vividly remember turning to him and very seriously saying, "Matt, I'm going to talk that way for the rest of my life." And I have. Which makes this next story particularly painful for both Chevy and me. Possibly more for Chevy. Anyway, at the charity ball the night before the tennis event, Chevy walked up to me and said, "I just want you to know I'm a big fan." This was incredible. I said, "Oh my God, all I do is steal from you." And we went on to have a mutually complimentary and quite lovely conversation. Next day, it was time to play tennis. Now, my skills were by this point admittedly rusty. I hadn't played in years, and my ground strokes needed a lot of work. What I did have, though, was an incredibly hard serve. In fact, they had a speed clock at the tournament, and I punched in at 111 miles per hour. The only problem was, I was not exactly sure where they were going. Which was fine at your everyday public court, not so fine in front of 2,000 people. Even former President George H.W. Bush was there. The game begins. I am first up to serve. I have my partner in the ad court, and on the opposite side is Chevy, also in the ad court near the net, and his partner back at the baseline to whom I would be serving directly. I toss up the ball, bring my racket around my back, hammer the tennis ball as hard as possible, and watch in horror as instead of it spearing across the court to Chevy's partner, it goes directly straight and it's heading for Chevy Chase. He is standing at the service line, which is exactly 60 feet from where I've hit the ball. This line is, coincidentally, the exact distance from the mound to home plate in baseball. So I can confidently tell you, if the ball was hit at about 100 miles per hour, this means it was traveling at about 146.7 feet per second, meaning Mr. Chase had 0.412 seconds to get out of the way. Mr. Chase did not get out of the way. More precisely, his testicles didn't get out of the way. I have just served something close to a professional speed serve right into his Chevy Chases, if you know what I mean. Here's what happened next. Chevy made a funny face, just like the one he makes in Fletch when a doctor gives him a prostate exam, and then dropped to the ground. Remember, all of this was going down in front of 2,000 people. Event now over, it took 4 medics to dash onto the court, strap him to a gurney, and rush him to the nearest hospital. If this is what I do to my heroes, Michael Keaton and Steve Martin better take cover. And thus concludes the violent section of this audiobook. Chapter 10, The Big Terrible Thing. Imagine this. You have to walk back onto a set where you have almost literally shat the bed for weeks before. You've been out of it, slurring lines, making bad decisions. You're in New York City, and even though you have not one but 2 sober companions, you call room service at the hotel, your voice shaking, detoxing, and say, "Please put a bottle of vodka in the bathtub in my room." Yes, the bathtub. Hide it in there. And then, when the day is done, you head back to that fucking hotel room and you drink the bottle of vodka, and you finally feel all right again for maybe 3 hours, and then have to do it all over again the next day. You're shaking, pretending that you are not in very serious trouble whenever you talk to anyone. Using that same shaky voice, you call the hotel and tell them to do the vodka bottle in the bathtub thing again. This is perhaps something that a normie, what we addicts call all you lucky non-alcoholics, might always struggle to understand. I'll have to take a stab at explaining it. When you drink an entire bottle of vodka, you are extremely sick the following day. Having a few drinks in the morning helps, but I was the lead in a giant studio movie, so I could not drink in the morning. You are sick and trembling, and it feels like every part of your insides is trying to squeeze out of your body. And that's all day. The entire 14-hour day. The only way to fix how sick you are is to drink the exact same amount or a little more the following night. "So just don't drink," says the normie. We alcoholics feel like we will literally go insane if we don't drink. Not to mention the alcoholic will be even sicker and look sicker if he doesn't drink the bottle. "But what about the movie?" "Doesn't matter, I have to drink." "How about taking a break for one night?" "Not possible." "Next question?" So, I'm in Dallas, I'm on methadone, a quart of vodka a day, cocaine, and Xanax. Every day I would show up to the set, pass out in my chair, wake up to do a scene, stumble to set, then just basically scream into camera for 2 minutes. Then it was back to my chair for further nap time. At this point in my life, I was one of the most famous people in the world. In fact, I was being burned by the white-hot flame of fame. Therefore, no one dared to say anything about this horrific behavior. The movie people wanted the film to be completed, slap my name on a poster, and make $60 million. And Friends, well, Friends was even worse. No one wanted to mess with that money-making machine. At one point during the filming of Serving Sarah, I thought maybe some Valium would help me somehow. A doctor arrived at my duplex hotel room to give me some. The night before he came to visit, I had drunk a party-sized bottle of vodka, the one with the handle on it. When the doctor looked around the room, he saw the bottle and said in a nervous voice, "Did you drink all of that?" "Yes," I said. "May I have the Valium every 4 hours, not every 6? With that, he turned tail and ran top speed down the spiral staircase and out the door, presumably so he wouldn't actually be in the room if Matthew Perry died. But away I went to rehab after Jamie Tarsus had told me I was disappearing and eventually came back to finish the movie. This was me during Serving Sarah. I was a mess. I felt so guilty and I apologized to everyone. And I like to think that I did a great job for the final 13 days of shooting. Everyone tried to be kind about it, and they were doing their best, but they were pissed off. The director was pissed off. I'd ruined his movie. Elizabeth Hurley, my co-star, was pissed off. She never got to do another movie either. I needed to make real amends. That's part of what AA teaches you. So I re-recorded my slurred parts for the entire movie, which meant I looped the entire movie. Days and days in a sound studio. 3 beeps in a studio, and I'd say my line to match my mouth. I happened to be good at that, and at the very least, we got the slurring out of the movie. Then I committed to doing the most press possible in the history of press, bending over backward to make things right. I was on the cover of everything, on every talk show you can think of. Of course the movie tanked anyway. I was paid $3.5 million to do the movie, and I got sued for the shutdown. Even though it was a health issue, at the mediation table, a team of insurance flacks faced me down, so I just wrote them a check for $650,000. I remember thinking, man, no one taught me the rules of life. I was a complete mess of a person, selfish and narcissistic. Everything had to be about me. And I matched that with a really handy inferiority complex, an almost fatal combo. I was all about myself from the time I was 10 years old, from the moment when I looked around and said, it's every man for himself. I had to be so focused on me just to keep myself together. But AA will teach you this is no way to live. One of the things you do in the 12 steps of AA is create a personal moral inventory. It's the fourth step. In it, you write down all the people that you're mad at and why. I had 68 names. 68. Then you write down how it affected you, and then you read it to someone. This is step 5. What I learned from this process, and by the care and love of a great sponsor to whom I read my list, was that I wasn't the center of the universe. It's kind of a relief learning that. There were other people around who had needs and cares and were just as important as I was. If you're shaking your head now, go on, have at it. Let he who is without sin cast the first stone. Sobriety had now become the most important thing in my life, because I learned that if you put anything in front of sobriety, you will lose that anything anyway if you drink. I read my list to my sponsor one beautiful spring day at a wonderful meditation center in Los Angeles called the Self-Realization Fellowship Lake Shrine. Perched on a hill overlooking the Pacific, the place is truly peaceful. There's a lake and gardens and temples and even a pod of some of Mahatma Gandhi's ashes, the only one stashed outside of India. As I finished reading out my list, we realized a wedding was starting in the gardens. I watched as the couple beamed at each other, the families in their best attire, an officiant smiling, waiting to warble on about sickness and health till death do they part. I hadn't been there for anyone for so long, my addiction being my best friend and my evil friend and my punisher and my lover all in one. My big, terrible thing. But that day, up there with the view, there always has to be a view, of course, and with the soon-to-be newlyweds and Gandhi somewhere nearby, I sensed an awakening. That I was here for more than this big, terrible thing. That I could help people, love them. Because of how far down the scale I had gone, I had a story to tell. A story that could really help people, and helping others had become the answer for me. On July 19, 2018, the New York Times front page featured stories about Donald Trump, Google, Putin's election meddling, and Maria Butina, a Russian agent who, according to the headline, had used sex in a covert plan. I knew none of this. Nor would I know anything for the next 2 weeks. Not that El Chapo got life plus 30 years. Not that some 19-year-old shot 3 people dead and himself at a garlic festival in Gilroy, California. Not that Boris Johnson became the UK Prime Minister. When I awoke from my coma, I was screaming. My mother was there. I asked her what happened. She told me my colon had exploded. "It's amazing that you're alive," she said. "Your resiliency is incredible. And with some life changes, you're going to be okay. And they can remove the colostomy bag in about 9 months." I thought, I have a colostomy bag? That's great. Girls find that to be a definite turn-on. I said, "Thank you very much." After that, I rolled over and really didn't talk or move for 2 weeks. I had been inches from death because of something that I had done. I was attached to 50 machines, and I would have to learn to walk again. I hated myself. I had almost killed myself. The shame, the loneliness, the regret were too much to handle. I just lay there, trying to deal with all of it, but there was no dealing with it. It had already been done. I was afraid to die, which was in direct opposition to my actions. But it was over. The Matthew Perry Show, canceled by opiates. Sometimes I could pay attention to what was going on in the room, but that was about it. I certainly wasn't taking part in anything. My best friends, Chris and Brian Murray, would come to visit. About 3 weeks into it, Maria, my sister on my father's side, came to see me. "Are you ready to hear what happened?" she said. I nodded, barely. "After your colon exploded, they put you on a ventilator, which you vomited into. So all of this bile and septic shit went into your lungs. They put you on an ECMO machine. Somehow you survived that, and you were in a coma for 14 days. After that, I don't think I spoke for another week, because I had realized that my greatest fear had come true, which is that I did this to myself. There was one upside, though. A 14-day coma makes it very simple to quit smoking. I had been on opiates and off opiates and back on different opiates for so long, I suffered from a situation that only a subset of the population gets. Opiates cause constipation. It's kind of poetic. I was so full of shit, it almost killed me. Also, I now had a bowel situation. The last thing I said to Aaron before the coma, as I was spinning on the ground in pain, right before I lost consciousness, was, "Don't leave me." I meant right then and there, but she, like the rest of my friends and family, took it literally. Aaron pulled the night shift for 5 months in the hospital. I often look back on that time and am so grateful that this happened before COVID, because then I would have been left alone in that room for 5 months. As it was, I was never alone in that room. That was God's love in human form, made flesh. Both my mom and I are experts in a crisis now. What I've always wanted to tell her is that little show called Friends, and all the other shows and movies, I essentially did it all for her attention. And yet that's the one person whose attention I did not really get from Friends. She mentioned it on occasion, but she was never boiling with pride about what her son had accomplished. But I don't think there's possibly a way that she could have been proud enough for what I needed. And if you're going to blame your parents for the bad stuff, you also have to give them credit for the good stuff. All the good stuff. I could never have played Chandler if my mother weren't my mother. I would never have made $80 million if my mother weren't my mother. Because Chandler was just a hider of true pain. What better character for a sitcom? To just make a joke about everything so we don't have to talk about anything real. That's how Chandler started. In the initial breakdown of the show, Chandler was supposed to be an observer of other people's lives. So he would be the guy who at the end of the scene would make some joke, comment on whatever just happened. The fool in King Lear, speaking truth where there had been none. But everyone ended up liking Chandler so much that he morphed into being his own major character. That he ended up superseding what I actually did in real life. Getting married, having kids. Well, some things I can't talk about that well. The bottom line.